Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Politics. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Paul Hansbury, author of Belarus in Crisis, From Domestic Unrest to the Russia-Ukraine War, published in April by Hearst. The war in Ukraine is entering what could well be its decisive phase as Kyiv prepares a counteroffensive using what will probably be a peak in Western arms supplies. In parallel, and according to them, in response to this and NATO's expansion into Finland, the Russians have announced plans to deploy tactical nuclear weapons into Belarus, with the storage facilities ready by July the 1st. Belarus's effective president for life, Alexander Lukashenko, has spent the past 29 years in office walking a tightrope between hugging Moscow close and clinging on to policy independence that is domestically popular and secures power for him, his family, and his allies. But the war to his south has forced Europe's last dictator to pick a side. Paul Hansbury's book explains why, by February 2022, Lukashenko had no choice. He writes, quote, "A quiet annexation of Belarus to Russia is largely happening, even if many Belarusians are unaware of the fact," and concludes that, quote, "the outcome of the Russia-Ukraine war has arguably become the decisive factor shaping Belarus's future statehood." Educated at Birkbeck, University of London, and St. Anthony's College, Oxford, Dr. Hansbury is a consulting analyst whose doctoral research was into the foreign policies of small powers, using Belarus as his primary case study. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
It's very good to be with you.
Well, let's start with, obviously the book, as the title suggests, is focused on the political and economic crisis in Belarus since 2020, but it's also a biography of a little-known nation. So to set the stage, could you give us a potted history of pre-Lukashenko Belarus and how it was that you ended up making Belarus your specialism?
So I'll start with the last part. I first visited Belarus back in 2008. I'd been going to Russia frequently to practice my language skills, and a Belarusian friend who was helping me with my Russian said, "Why don't you go to Belarus and I can put you in touch with people to show you around." And so I went to Belarus, and I recognized that this was a country that was actually quite different to Russia in many respects, and that it was a country that very few people in the UK, where I live, knew very much about. Somehow the consequence of my first holiday in Belarus was that I ended up writing a PhD about Belarusian foreign policy, as you do after going on holiday somewhere. And I guess I'm the kind of person that just persists with things. So now there's a book. So you asked for a potted history. This is a territory in Eastern Europe that has, over the centuries, passed from control of one overlord to another. So from the the 13th century onwards, it was part, it was within the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, which was this huge state stretching the length of Eastern Europe. And then with time that the Lithuanian and Polish crowns merged. And so now Belarusian territory was part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And that continues up until the end of the 18th century when Poland was broken up. And now the lands were absorbed into the land was absorbed into the Russian Empire. And this sort of takes us through, continues through to the First World War. The end of the First World War, Poland is put back on the map, and now Belarus is divided. It finds itself half in what is now Poland, and half, and Eastern Belarus is in what was now Bolshevik Russia. Interesting bit for the future of Belarus is that in this this moment at the end of World War One, there's a very brief effort at statehood, very brief, but there was something called the Belarusian People's Republic. But that disappears very, doesn't really attain recognition. It's not until the collapse of the Soviet Union in at the end of 1991 that Belarus first attains a sovereignty that is seriously and widely recognized. And then you get a very brief period of uncertain politics up until 1994, various political forces vying for power. And then in 1994, Alexander Lukashenko was elected as president. And he reclaimed his mandate through a series of elections that are widely understood to have been rigged. Lukashenko has even joked about that fact. For example, he said at one time in the past, yes, sure, the result was manipulated to give him an 80% vote share, claiming that no one believed the real figure, which was higher yet. And so he rules with an iron fist, if you like, for the best part of three decades. And anyway, come 2020, for various reasons I describe in the book, there was now a lot of discontent among Belarusians towards the status quo. And so we saw these huge street protests against the autocratic regime of Alexander Lukashenko.
Yeah, that's a very interesting background, and it really covers the first chapter of your book. Fundamental to that, or the way it plays into post-Lukashenko politics, is this process you describe in the book as one side of domestic politics having this east-oriented nation-building project and another side having a west-oriented nation-building project. While Lukashenko has clearly chosen the eastern path, he has until now teased Western themes and played off the European Union against Russia and against China. And as you mentioned there, Poland still has this quite significant purchase in domestic politics. Can you take us through that that argument from your book?
Indeed. So in international affairs, Lukashenko has a reputation for playing different sides off against one another, outside actors. His trick has long been to present himself to Russia as a defensive outpost against Western expansionism, and the idea that Western states are sponsoring regime change politics, and then claim support from Russia accordingly, while at the same time telling states in the West that he needs saving from Russia, and playing on helplessness a little bit. He's quite wily in that regard. I mean, even now you see in recent months how he's frankly exaggerating the NATO threat as a way of scaring Russia into conceding to his demands. It's hard to think that even Vladimir Putin takes him all that seriously right now. But Poland is quite central to that. Poland is presented by the Lukashenko regime as an imperialistic power seeking to reclaim its control over Belarusian territory. The Lukashenko and those around him tend to point to a number of elements in this. They point to the fact that Poland was one of the drivers behind the European Union's Eastern Partnership Initiative, the fact that Poland has for many years been broadcasting radio programs into Belarus and has very much promoted a historical national identity of Belarusians that is at odds with the one that Lukashenko and his cohort advocate. I would say as well, though, so whereas for a while this idea of Lukashenko playing off outside actors against one another, for a while that was the EU and Russia, more recently Lukashenko has talked up the prospects of benefiting from trading with China and also seeking some kind of security guarantees from China. And China, through the past decade or so, has kind of, it seems in the eyes of the regime, has sort of rose on the horizon as a dazzling prospect. But I would say that the picture is quite confused at best. Trade data, when it's issued quarterly, say, you know, some quarters it looks good, some quarters it looks less good. It looks like things are not going so favorably. But it's, these are off of low baselines. But Belarus has been able to use China as a way of playing off against Russia. So I give a case in the book where Russia was withholding the disbursement of a tranche of a loan to Belarus because it was unhappy with something in that Belarus was dragging its feet on in its domestic politics. And Mr. Lukashenko turned at this point to China and got some money from there instead.
It is hard to see, though, what China gets out of this at this stage. I mean, given the application of sanctions on Belarus as well as Russia, and that this is something you really communicates in the book, is how while he did have these, you know, he has had this policy over the last 30 years of trying to keep Russia close, but have this policy of sort of semi-equidistance, it really does seem to have run out of road at this stage. I mean, you say, for example, that not just politically but economically, Belarus has become steadily more dependent on Russia. Can you explain how? And also, you discuss this idea of the union state that Russia and Belarus have been talking about for a while, which you seem pretty skeptical about. Do you think it's more or less likely, assuming that the Putin regime survives this, what is probably going to turn out to be a frozen conflict with Ukraine?
So, and I agree with the first thing you said at the start there, that it's not obvious that Belarus is so useful to China these days. I mean, back in the past, it could try to present itself as a gateway into EU markets, but that's clearly not possible now, given how isolated Belarus is under sanctions. So the Union State is a good example of both Belarus's growing economic and political dependence on Russia, I would say. So listeners might not know very much about the Union State. It's this slightly odd conception, a legacy of the 1990s. At the end of his time in office, Russia's President Yeltsin had signed the Union State Treaty with Lukashenko. And for most of the time, this looked like little more than a piece of paper. They formed various bodies, but when Putin came into office, he didn't really seem to understand what it was about. But he's ostensibly been a way to deal with ideas about reintegration between the two countries. And more on the backdrop of the... It came to quite prominent again when there was a debate about how Putin might stay in office in Russia after 2020. And whether he might use the union state as a way of taking power. Now, that wasn't hugely convincing to me. The union state has been a way for Russia to tie Belarus much more closely to it. So it feels like with the Russian perception has been for the union state as being a way of, in effect, absorbing Belarus back into its fuller control. Although for Belarus, traditionally, the Lukashenko regime has long argued for some unrealistic notion of equality between the two members. Where we are today is that various programs have been signed, headed toward in direction of things like harmonizing taxation, indirect taxation in the first instance. But you can see the steps that you move along in integration, you move from into direct taxation, and once you have common fiscal and monetary policy, then you're kind of ahead of the European Union on integration. But, you know, at present, right, we should remember that the two states don't have a single currency, despite it being talked of since the 1990s. And so it's not that clear that there's much beyond technical cooperation has been agreed on formally. But, I mean, if it were properly realised, then that's the point that it means Belarus has basically ceased to exist in nominal terms, even in anything but nominal terms, because you have one political unit, one government, one head of state. And this kind of feeds into the way Putin views Belarus and also Ukraine, I think. You will recall that Putin has said some pretty insulting things about Ukraine even before last year's invasion, even before 2014 and the Maidan revolution. You know, we can go back to the conversations on the sidelines of the NATO summit in Bucharest in 2008, when Putin reportedly described Ukraine as an artificial state. And then more recently, in the summer of 2021, he wrote this essay, which was widely read in policy circles in Western Europe, EU capitals, in North America, where he talked about the historical unity of Russians and Ukrainians, but as well as Belarusians. And he sort of described the modern state of Ukraine is occupying historical Russian lands in that essay. And it's not much of an imaginative leap to think that he understands the Belarusian state in a similar way, as a kind of Russophobic project sponsored by countries like Poland and Western states. And so he doesn't see Belarus as authentic in this regard. So, and that has traditionally been slightly at odds with what the Lukashenko regime has tried to do, because whatever their views on history are, they understand that sovereignty is a prized possession, something to be guarded with jealousy. So it's that Lukashenko's ability to hold out against Russia has largely collapsed at this point.
Yeah, it also seems to be at odds with, as far as we could make of it, at odds with public opinion, because, you know, it's difficult to poll in a country like Belarus, as you make clear in the book, but it does seem as though most Belarusians are opposed to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And yet we haven't seen the kind of demonstrations we saw in 2020 against the election result. Do you think that's simply because of the the severity of the prison sentences that you do cover, I mean, it's amazing. There was one election, I think one of the ones in the teens, where you say that pretty much every opposition leader who'd run against him ended up in prison after the election. So do you think it's that, or is there a certain resigned, people are resigned to the fact that this guy has been in power for three decades and they just think he's always going to be there?
I think both of those things, plus I would point to an additional factor as well. I agree with you that Belarusian public opinion looks against the war. Chatham House did some polling in March. They just released the data. That finds 30% of their respondents supported the war, 45 or so percent against it, and then there's a large undecided middle. There's an undecided middle, so sort of a quarter of the population. And then overwhelmingly, they don't want to see Belarusian troops involved. Then the numbers against shoot up considerably. And that does put them at odds with Russian public opinion. So I do think partly people are cowed into silence. The repressions, particularly on protests after 2020, were pretty extreme. The numbers are in prison. The number of people who are detained is very high. This can be for any sign of dissent or indeed any sign of supporting Ukraine's war effort is crept down on. And we have the reports from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights documenting cases of beating of protesters and such forth. So there is that element that people are cowed into submission, and they know that family members might get taken aside for a talking to, and this is quite intimidating. And I think that feeds into what you described as resignedness. But there is also another factor here. So clearly a lot of the most ardent protests, people who might lead the protests, some of them are now in prison, but also a great number of people have left the country. I don't have figures for how many Belarusians have emigrated since August 2020, but I think it's rather a lot.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah. You do seem confident there. You said this a couple of times in the book, that Lukashenko himself still can count on the support of around 25 to 35% of the population. What gives you confidence in this number, given the difficulty of polling, getting reliable polling information?
So I do think that's right. I do think he retains the core support. And I base that on what little polling we do have, combined with some other factors, sort of awareness of what I see among Belarusians. I would say my level of confidence in that assessment can only be moderate to high, rather than high. Because even the small number of sociologists, political scientists who are able to conduct some kind of polling in Belarus, do say they don't know the number supportive of the regime. I mentioned that Chatham House is doing polling. There are various others. As you say, polling is a challenging environment, and there are some errors. So most of these polls, through no fault of the pollsters, they suffer from sampling problems. The group of people they can survey, from which they are generalizing, is not really representative of the population as a whole. And I think most of the people conducting these surveys do acknowledge that their methods tend to skew their samples towards the opposition to Lukashenko. So that's one component of this. Now, they do things. They try to introduce quotas or weighting, but that can amplify abnormal responses. By that, I mean, if you know that from a certain demographic group, you should have 20 people in your survey and you only have three, then there might be something about that three that makes them unrepresentative of that component of the demographic. So by giving them extra weight, sort of multiplying that three so that it makes 20, can just perpetuate a false result. But the polls that there are do seem to show that you have sort of around 30% still quite loyal to Lukashenko. Historically, it's been much higher. Now, there are also problems of misreporting, which can work both ways. There are reasons why if you support Lukashenko and a Western think tank asks you your opinion, you might think it's socially desirable to tell a fib and claim that you support the opposition. And perhaps more likely, if you're in Belarus, you fear being found out expressing your dissent for the opposition, your support for the opposition, so you fib and say you support Lukashenko. So we've got quite some different dynamics pulling in different directions. And so it's kind of bringing these things together that brings me to my assessment that Lukashenko does have that support. Ah, I've got a fire alarm. So it's challenging to draw conclusions from the polls on their own. But for that reason, and one issue that I do think is highly relevant here is to start trying to bring in other bits of information which we can obtain from surveys. They're not identical with the question of who do you support, but they give us an impression of people's worldviews. And so there was a sociological survey conducted in the second half of 2022. Too late for inclusion in my book or mention in my book. But that asked how Belarusians understood their identity. And that found a third of people ascribing to what we could think of as Soviet or Russian national ideas, the ideas that are pushed by the Lukashenko regime. And you've also got a group of people who are quite indifferent to politics all along, and they probably still is some people in that group. While in the book I argue that the protests awaken some kind of a political culture in Belarus, at the same time there's still such a large legacy of from the past, and that's been so suppressed by Lukashenko that I think a lot of people are still inclined to stick with the status quo. So in the post 2020, the mood, the spirit of that time was clearly anti Lukashenko. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, one of the first effects of that in the polling was that some of the people in the middle sort of shifted back towards support for the regime, and in a sort of, well, this is better than what we're seeing in to our south. So that's a picture of some of the components that I'm putting together to come up with my view that he still does have this support base of about a third. I can't be highly confident in that.
That is what makes me wonder about what could happen with the deployment of tactical Russian weapons in Belarus, given this what appears to be quite strong opposition to direct involvement in the war. If it's one thing to send troops south, but it's arguable that it's pretty much doing the same thing having Russian weapons on their soil. Do you think this is the kind of thing that could tip public opinion or even opinion within the regime against Lukashenko?
I think it will be unpopular if nuclear weapons are deployed in Belarus. We see that in democracies, right? You can have the 1980s when the CND's membership rose massively and as it spearheaded deployments against Pershing missiles. The Scottish National Party want Britain's nuclear submarines to be stationed away from Scotland. So as much as anything else, there's a common sense element that says it will be unpopular. It's kind of ironic that nuclear weapons are deployed in the name of people's so-called security, and yet they make people feel quite insecure. And we know that so the Chatham House polls find 80% of people are in Belarus are opposed to having nuclear weapons on their soil. Lukashenko's claims to the contrary are somewhat perverse. Although I imagine that that in itself is not an issue that people will take to the streets over. If Lukashenko were to commit troops to fight alongside Russia in Ukraine, then that's more likely to provoke a popular reaction. And I think actually his awareness of that has probably what's stopped it from happening. You also suggested that some of his inner circle might turn against him on this question. That is something I do not think I really am in a position to answer.
Well, actually, on that, you write that immediately after the invasion, the then Foreign Minister Mackay made some overtures to the EU, which were rebuffed. And then Lukashenko himself complained the war was dragging on, and one of his ambassadors said Belarus hadn't invited the Russians in to stage the invasion. Mackay was seen, rightly or wrongly, and I'd be interested in your opinion on that, as the most West-oriented figure in the administration, and he suddenly died in November. Do you have suspicions around that death? And B, was that a moment at which you think Lukashenko essentially surrendered to this soft annexation that's going on, that you identify as going on at the moment?
So Vladimir Mackay was Belarus's long-serving foreign minister, and been in that role for a decade. It was essentially his job to keep relations going with other states. He was always loyal to Lukashenko. He had served as the head of the presidential administration in the past, and Lukashenko trusted him, I think. Sometimes his liberalism is exaggerated by people. But in relative terms, he was viewed as a less hardline figure, someone keener to maintain good relations with all parties, far more so than some around him. So he went down relatively well with Western diplomats. If we look at his tenure in the round, and it's important, the qualifier relatively is important here, because relations with Belarus have been turbulent through and through. So he understood the benefits of diversifying the country's international relations. He understood the need to decrease its dependence on Russia. And so the MFA, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs under Mackay, was seen as one of the more liberal government departments, perhaps alongside some people in the finance ministry. And then he died suddenly in November last year. So he was a man in his middle 60s in a high pressure job. Although there was no formal cause of death announced, it was initially suggested he'd had a heart attack, and I think that is quite plausible. There were inevitably some conspiracy theories, some claims that Russia was unhappy because he was making overtures to the West and that they had murdered him, or similar. In isolation, I would be disinclined to give too much credence to that. It's of course possible, but I think it's more likely they were natural causes. And then in more recently, there have been other suggestions that he may have taken his own life. But again, these are rumors. I am not really in a position to comment on those. I think it's quite plausible that he had a heart attack. So your part B of your question was about the soft annexation. Would I describe? So I think I think what you said is that the moment I would describe as the moment of the soft annexation. I think often things like power shifts in politics, loss of sovereignty, these are things that actually happen unnoticed. They're realized later. So you get that, I'd call it the Suez analogy. Britain had lost its power by the end of World War II, but it took a little bit before people realized the extent of that. It took the Suez crisis to actually think, okay. And people suddenly grasped the fact. So in terms of the Belarus and its sovereignty, I think the moment where we grasp that how much has been ceded is probably earlier. It's probably when Russia launches its invasion in part from Belarus. I think after 2020, in return for support, Lukashenko was left with very few options in the eyes of EU governments, Washington, London as well, and others. He was seen as delegitimized, quite rightly so. And so regime security became all that mattered to him at that point. And in that context, he has made concessions to Russia. It's not entirely clear what he was doing, the whens and the hows, but I think come February last year, we can see how little autonomy, in fact, the Belarus doesn't really have any meaningful autonomy to talk of. And so we saw it after 2020, there were signs Belarus had tried to maintain a line where it hadn't de facto de jure recognized Russia's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula. After 2020, Lukashenko yielded on that point and said, well, it's Russia. And so there's just been this build-up of evidence. But I suppose the key point is that Russia never really needed to do this in a moment. It could bide its time. It knows that Lukashenko had fewer and fewer options. And so a creeping annexation of Belarus is something that can happen without an international furore, in a way. It can be presented as a fait accompli.
I just want to come up with a hypothetical. I mean, there were these documents that were leaked from Ukrainian intelligence that said that if Lukashenko had fallen in 2020, the Russians would have not done a creeping annexation, they would have done an actual annexation. Do you think in that circumstance now, if the Russians really did send in troops to occupy Belarus, that there would be significant resistance, or do you think the population is too cowed?
I think there would be some resistance. It's hard to tell. I think that would provoke quite a strong reaction. Historically, it's been pretty clear that Belarusians do not want to be part of Russia. So there would be a reaction. The scale of it is hard to say. I mean, at the moment, you have a significant number of Belarusians who have gone as volunteers to fight in Ukraine, and they have very much consolidated around. So initially there were various regiments of volunteer fighters. First thing that happened was that the Ukrainian Territorial Reserve formally incorporated a lot of them into its structures. But then within the Belarusians themselves, a lot of them have consolidated around the behind something called the Kalinovsky regiment. And there, so a lot of the nationalist forces, pro-democracy movement from Belarus in the 1990s, people associated with that, have fallen into line behind this new kind of core. And I think that if Russia were to send troops into Belarus and try to announce that Belarus was formally annexed to Russia, I think you would see some of that group that have been fighting in Ukraine quickly move back to Belarus and take up the fight there. That would be my guess, but we are talking about hypotheticals. And
You conclude the book by saying, quote, Lukashenko's position looks hopeless whatever happens. He has kept the loyalty of political elites, but an orderly transition to a chosen successor looks unlikely in such circumstances because disputes about policy will all too quickly surface. The regime will break, not bend. I mean, he has sort of floated over the years a succession to one of his sons. His favorite seems to be the younger son at the moment. But you seem skeptical that he's going to be able to manage anything like that. Could you explain why?
So, I mean, I don't think he will go quietly. I don't think, so his youngest son, Olya, I don't think that would go down well among the elite. I think he would, the younger son would be viewed as something of a whippersnapper if Lukashenko tried to pass power to him. I mean, one of the key organizing ideas in the book was that 2020 represented a maturation of political culture among Belarusians, that there was some kind of political awakening. But because Lukashenko hasn't allowed the political and civic institutions that can facilitate change, manage transformation, his only option really would be to try to hand off power in that way. But I think that's where you would see the elite within his sort of inner circle. You would see a lot of ruffled feathers, people that think, well, actually, this is really their moment. And so that will cause problems. And without this kind of this institutional framework to manage change, all I can really see happening is that there's a snapping of the status quo. Quite what that looks like, I mean, I don't want to speculate too much, but unfortunately, I can't really see that there's an easy ride ahead for Belarusians. Towards the end of the book, I sort of point to an increasing militarization on both sides, both regime and its opponents. And so if Lukashenko is... it could be quite messy, I suppose, is what I'm saying there. Mm.
And you seem a little skeptical about the domestic influence of the opposition, who most of whom are living abroad, like Tsikhanouskaya. Do you think they lack legitimacy at home?
So the problem for a lot of Belarusians is, particularly if they are being fed a diet of state media, is that they probably don't know very much about what Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya and those around her are doing. Tsikhanouskaya's visibility is probably higher within the EU, the UK, US, than it is within Belarus itself, certainly among a large swath of the Belarusian population. It's worth bearing in mind the circumstances that brought her to become this figurehead of the democratic movement. She, you know, I said at the time, and I still think it, she represented this a kind of zeitgeist, the spirit of anti-Lukashenko opinion at that point in 2020. But she wasn't someone who was standing up with a political program and a long-term plan for the country. She, yeah, she went into the 2020 election promising another vote 6 months down the line. So she solved a collective action problem, if you like, but she was not a long-term solution. And even today, the opposition around her have a full political program? Not really, I would say. As of last summer, she has created a cabinet, and they have individuals assigned various portfolios. There's an economy minister, a defense minister, a foreign minister. But the word minister is a little bit of a misnomer here. So they are dealing with some really important issues in the present, like someone is responsible for lobbying for political prisoners and trying to help that situation, for example. But that doesn't tell us what would happen if there was actually a fundamental change of regime in Belarus and whether or not they would be in a position to take power. That's part of why I think that post-Lukashenko Belarus will be something of a muddle. It will be very, you know, if you put Svetlana Tikhanovskaya into the role of president, then I think she would be reliant on an awful lot of advice and support from outside actors, and whether or not outside actors have the willingness and resources to provide that support is an open question.
But as always, to close, because this is a podcast about books, I've asked my guest to recommend two, one from his field and one personal choice. Paul, what have you chosen?
So first of all, I've chosen Karen Dowish's book, Putin's Kleptocracy. I only read this for the first time very recently, and I've read several books or many books about corruption in Russia, bad behavior by the Putin elite, but none of them is as persuasive as Dowish's book. She is incredibly well-sourced, and probably more than any book I've read about the Putin regime in the past couple of years, it's really changed some of my views about the extent of malfeasance in the Russian elite. So that's what I'm calling my field.
Right. Okay. And the second one?
So for my second book, I wanted to go with a novel because I read a lot of novels. And I've chosen Joseph Conrad's Nostromo. This is a book that I find an incredibly absorbing story. I've read it several times. It concerns a fictional country in South America that has a long history of living under dictatorship. And in it, one of the characters has an unpublished book manuscript, which at one point is given the title 30 Years of Misrule. And I can't help but note, by way of conclusion, that Mr. Lukashenko is about to enter his 30th year in power. And one wonders if it might be the last.
Right, good choices. Well, today I've been talking to Paul Hansbury about his Belarusian Crisis, published this month by Hearst. Paul, thanks again for coming on.
It's an honour to have been with you.